Good morning, everyone. Is this working? Yeah. Can you hear me in the back? Okay, so this talk is going to be a little different from a lot of the talks at this conference, though I think relevant. And I'll talk to you about sort of a toy model that I worked on with Andy Strominger, where we studied two-dimensional string theory in a time-dependent context. And I have an annotated title here. When I say matrix models, I mean the sequels to one matrix. To those of you who know that mean, now you know what I'm going to talk about. And I want to just remind you that two-dimensional setup is sort of Poulmann's cosmology, because in two dimensions, we don't really have dynamical gravity. And string theory in two dimensions has a very minimal matter content. So this really is a toy model. So let me begin by motivating why we're going to talk about this. So time-dependent string theory is a subject that's really in its infancy. We don't understand how to deal with string theory in time-dependent setups, except in some very small number of cases, most of which we really are doing effective theory. And there has been some small number of developments recently, or attempts at remedying the situation, for example, in the context of open string tachyon condensation. But really, the whole subject of how do you deal with string theory in a time-dependent background is still wide open. And the reason why it's so hard is because it requires a certain amount of non-perturbative analysis, and most of the time you lose supersymmetry. And so we lose all of the tools that allow us to do non-perturbative string theory, and we do need to do some kind of non-perturbative analysis. And this is why it's so difficult, or one of the reasons why it's so difficult to understand the Sitter space. And clearly, we have to solve these problems if we're ever going to have a hope of really doing string cosmology. And so for this talk, I'm going to show you how you can use two-dimensional string as a toy model to look at some of these questions. And basically, what I'm going to do is just show you how time-dependent situations can be described non-perturbatively in two-dimensional string. And the reason why we did it in two dimensions is because in two dimensions, there is a fully non-perturbative definition of the theory that is both known and fairly well studied and actually fairly easy to work with, as opposed to a lot of the tri-dimensional, for example, matrix models, which while in principle they describe the theory non-perturbatively, it's very difficult to extract things from them. This one is much easier. So for those of you who are not familiar with this model, I will begin by describing what it is. I will not have time to motivate why this model, why this particular the way of describing two-dimensional string theory is true. That's an hour-long talk all by itself. So you'll have to take for granted that this really does describe two-dimensional string. And the model I will talk about is the C equals to one matrix model. And I'll talk about it in the fermion picture, in which it becomes really simple. And the following thing happens. You start with a single n by n matrix, a real matrix, where n is some large number. And you study its quantum mechanics in a certain setup. And the quantum mechanics is such as that the only things that are relevant for physics are the eigenvalues of the matrices, of the single matrix. And so the whole problem reduces to the quantum mechanics of some n variables. And it turns out that when you take account of all the determinants that go into the thing when you reduce it down to just the eigenvalues, these eigenvalues become fermionic, meaning that the wave function must anti-commute, must be anti-symmetric in those eigenvalues, and that they are free, meaning that the individual eigenvalues do not interact with each other, except through the Pauli exclusion principle. And then you get this, in the limit in which you obtain string theory, you get this extremely simple Hamiltonian, which is just the inverted harmonic oscillator. So here's the potential. And the normal setup, which has been studied very, very extensively since sort of the 80s into the mid-90s, is that what you do is you take this n over here. So this is the number of fermions in my system to be a very, very large number. In fact, you take it to infinity so that you can fill up this potential is unbounded from below. You can fill up this potential all the way from negative infinity up to some level of energy, and you fill up all the eigenvalues in between. And it is conjectured and thoroughly well tested, and to some extent sort of motivated, or maybe not proved, that this setup precisely describes what is a two-dimensional string with a Liouville background, which I'll describe in a moment. So this is the setup in which I will be doing all of my computations. And in particular, I will treat these fermions in the phase space. So here's phase space. This is x. Sorry, I haven't labeled these axes. This is x, and the vertical axis is p. And we'll also treat them in the semi-classical approximation. In the semi-classical approximation, each fermion, in which are here denoted with the little dots, has a Planck size, an h-bar size cell surrounding it. That's due to Fermi principle. And you can just think of this, of having this incompressible Fermi fluid as sloshing around in this space under the equations of motion. And the equations of motion are that the derivative of x is p, and the derivative of p is x, so it's extremely simple. And you really, if you, the easiest way to picture, well, okay, so the solution of these equations of motion is a hyperbola. But the easiest way to picture sometimes what's going on geometrically is to turn the graph around and realize that the equations of motion can be written in this form, that x plus or minus p, its time derivative, is plus or minus x plus or minus p. And so that in these variables, the time evolution simply squishes things in this direction and stretches them in this direction. And the hyperbolas are invariant under this motion. So here is a single fermion moving on its classical trajectory, surrounded by its little cell that prevents it from bumping into other fermions. And here is the top of the, let me go back to this position. Here is the top of the Fermi surface. And really, the whole problem reduces down in this approximation to computing the shape of the surface and its time evolution, for which we have a very, very fairly simple equations of motion. So that's a semi-classical approximation. Now, so what string theory does this correspond to? The string theory this corresponds to is the two-dimensional Liouville string, for which I will not write down the worksheet action, because for those of you who know it, you know, you don't need you, and for those of you who don't know it, it'll just confuse you. So let's talk about it in the effective theory, which is actually a little easier to understand. The gravity in two dimensions is coming from string theory pretty much reduces to dilaton gravity. And so all I have is the dilaton, and we're going to be interested in a particular solution where the dilaton over here is linear. And you might know that in string theory, the dilaton gives you the string coupling. And so if I have a linear dilaton, the coupling varies exponentially from the weak coupling region to the strong coupling region as a function of my coordinate x1. There is also, I will also have, well, so the entire we're used to string theory giving us an entire tower of states. It turns out that in two dimensions, this entire tower essentially collapses down to just a single state, which we call the tachyon because it comes, in terms of the structure of string theory, from the place where the bosonic tachyon normally comes from. However, it is massless. And so this closed string theory is actually perturbatively stable. There is no tachyon. The tachyon is a massless particle. And over here in the weak coupling regime, it just moves freely. However, there is a solution defective theory in which the tachyon field itself is an exponential field, and it gives a potential to the oscillations from which these oscillations can bounce. And so you can think of this as having some kind of a potential wall over here, which completely shields the strong coupling region away from all of these degrees of freedom. Okay, so let me just repeat what we have. We have a tachyon field, which you can think of in two ways. You can think of A, it is there is a non-trivial background of this tachyon field. There is some small perturbative degrees of freedom which reflect from this potential. And just to make it more like a cosmology talk, here is the Penrose diagram. So the space is flat. There is the Liouville potential. So things to reflect up this potential. And here's our little massless field happily living on its log line. And coupling is weak on this side and strong on that side. And I have control by deciding where I put this wall of how strong coupling is at the Liouville wall. So this is the string. And you are probably by now wondering, what do these fermions have to do with a string? So here is a cartoon picture of how that works. For any fluctuation of the Fermi surface, which I can also picture as a fluctuation of Fermi surface in my phase space, it can travel along the Fermi surface, reflect off the potential, the turning point, and come back. Or in other words, it will travel along the hyperbola under the equations of motion. This is precisely as closed string that some bit of closed string radiation that will come in, reflect off the potential, and come out. So this is how this correspondence works. And we can think of these, in the approximations that I'm going to be making, we can think of these closed strings as being essentially fluctuations in the classical field. And so the shape of the Fermi surface, which is over here, which has some fluctuation on it that will travel down, can be written down, can be translated into a fluctuation of the shape of the tachyon potential. And there's a known dictionary for this, which was mostly developed by Polchinski over here, and it over a number of years with some collaborators. And so one more thing I'm just going to mention is that there's, of course, a change of variables. This variable only runs from negative infinity to zero, and this variable only runs from negative infinity to positive infinity, and so the string variable, x1, is related to the fermionic variable x with a logarithm. So we just exponentiate. We have an exponential map relating the two. OK. So here's going to be the philosophy of this talk. So what I have described so far is the standard setup for how you obtain the Liouville string, the two-dimensional Liouville string, from its matrix model. This has been very well studied. All scattering amplitudes have been computed in matrix models, and where they can be computed in the exact CFT, which is known for this case, on the string side, they have been compared and they have been found to agree with some technical difficulties. And so this is all well known. But this is a static background. So we were interested in seeing whether you could make this background move, and not just little tiny fluctuations, but really have the whole structure of space-time change in this model. And so the philosophy that I'm going to present is that I'm going to take that any state of this fermion theory with any number of fermions in it. So I've talked about filling up the C up to some level, and that has some infinite number of fermions in it. I'm going to assume that I can change this number of fermions. So I'm going to put any number of fermions into this potential. And I'm going to insist that any state of this theory should define some kind of string theory. Of course, not if you just put in some completely crazy state, you might have no tools for describing what a string theory is. So we'll limit ourselves to some very specific situations where we have an interpretation as a string theory. But in principle, because the fermion model is a non-perturbative definition of the string theory, this statement should be true. This is what it means to have a non-perturbative definition, is that no matter what you throw in there, it defines something. So in particular, I'm going to show you and try to convince you that if I put in a finite number of fermions into this potential instead of the whole infinite C, then I get something that looks like a finite cosmology, meaning a cosmology in the compact direction, though it will be a strange cosmology. And so I'm going to go through, in the next little while, through two examples, describing a finite cosmology, and then going on to describing how in this system you can actually describe a process that we have called tachyon condensation. OK. So some pictures. There's going to be a lot of pictures. So let's imagine. I have told you that I was going to take this phase diagram, and I was going to fill everything to the left of this hyperbola. Well, what would happen if I filled everything to the right of the hyperbola? And don't worry about this upper straight lines here, this there's ways of dealing with them. But let's just think about filling the Fermi C not all the way below some energy, but all the way above some energy. So at first glance, you would think that this theory is problematic because sort of all of your, every single little perturbation in there looks like it has negative kinetic energy. But actually, this isn't very important because this is just particle Hall duality. These are fermions. I have a duality. They're not interacting. I have a duality between particles and Halls. And I can just exchange all the particles and all the Halls and get back from here to my normal setup. So I'll claim that at least perturbatively, when I can ignore the fact that I filled everything, that I have a problem over here, at least perturbatively, this Fermi surface is just good as the Fermi surface as the other one for defining the Liouville universe. So if I can do this, then let's think about doing that, where what I've done is I have chosen two hyperbolas that are fairly well spaced from each other so that they can fluctuate without interfering with each other. And I have filled the Fermi C right between them. Now what I should be getting is two universes. I have two surfaces. So you can think of as either two universes or one universe with two independent degrees of freedom. Those degrees of freedom do not interact perturbatively. But if a fluctuation happens to be so big that it sort of gets from this surface over to that surface, then of course you will get interactions. That turns out to be a fluctuation that has an energy on the order of string scale. And so those are large fluctuations. But for small energy stuff, this just looks like two sheets of some same universe with two different string couplings. OK, but this isn't quite what I want yet, because both of these setups have infinite number of fermions in them. And the way you tell is that you try to compute the area of this field and region, and you calculate the integral, and you get infinity. And so I need an infinite number of Planck-sized cells to fill that in. I have an infinite number of fermions. However, I can take care of that by simply cutting this little crescent off at some fixed point. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to say, let's take a handful of fermions, and let's throw them into this state. And this state has a finite number of fermions in it, corresponding to finite area over here. However, the state will evolve. It's easy to see here because we know that the time evolution moves everything over like this on hyperbolas. But it's also quite easy to see if we go back and think about the potential. What have we done? Well, we have asked, instead of filling the whole C, we have only filled it in between two different energy levels, and we have cut it off. Well, this is just a fistful of fermions thrown on the side of a potential. So if you think about a single particle thrown on the side of the potential, it will roll down. And so the same thing will happen to these fermions. They'll start, as collectively, they will roll down the whole potential, which is described here as this crescent moving along. So what does this look like? Well, sure. Sorry? I want the cutoff to be large, and you'll see in a second why from this picture. So here is what the time evolution will look like. The crescent will simply move along the hyperbolic trajectory and stretch. It becomes very thin and very long very quickly. And so now imagine that you were a little perturbation that, say, started out over here on the bottom surface. Well, here you are traveling along the hyperbola. You end up around here. And then you come out. And actually, you've never seen the fact that your universe has an end. So a little perturbation sitting right in the middle of this universe, or of this crescent, from the point of your fermions, is not aware of the fact that actually the Fermi C is only filled to some ends. And for that, of course, I need this to be large. But here's our universe moving along. And those perturbations really don't know that the universe ends. However, it's a little peculiar because if I look at some early time when I just have this piece, both the fluctuations on the top surface and the fluctuations on the bottom surface are moving in this direction. And so the universe is filled with particles that are all moving to the right. They're moving with the speed of light, and they're all moving to the right. On the other hand, later in the time evolution, the universe is filled with particles that are moving to the left. And this is how one resolves this funny thing that, you know, I told you earlier that if I was over here, that I could have, that it didn't matter whether I took the top surface or the bottom, whether I fill it from the top or from the bottom, because I have particle hole duality. This argument doesn't, of course, quite apply to this situation. And in fact, one of the fields does have a kinetic term that's an opposite sign from the kinetic term of this thing. But in fact, when you rewrite it, it turns out that you can think of two free fields, one with a positive kinetic sign, one with a negative kinetic sign, as in fact two chiral fields moving in either the left or the right, depending on the precise signs between things. So this is precisely what's happening. So here is the sort of Penrose diagram for this universe. I've drawn in here out of the original full flat space. And in green, I have drawn the Liouville wall. And then in the dark black lines, you have the boundaries of this universe, which are just defined by where this Fermi C ends. And in between, here is some little perturbation, which happily scatters up the wall as if nothing was happening. And coupling is weak over here. And we have to remember we actually have two sheets to this. So this would be the rough space-time interpretation of a setup like that.
The vector flat go out.
Sorry?
The vector, you mean the metric flat go out?
Yes. Well, this is a 1+1 dimensional theory. So the one dimension cannot actually curve. There might be a two-dimensional curvature, yeah, which within what we can compute for this particular setup, no. But with what I'm going to draw in just a second, maybe.
So is this Penrose diagram picture supposed to be referring to the x1 coordinate? Or?
Yes, this is the x1 string coordinate.
Okay, that's an x1.
Right. So the phase diagrams are always drawn in the fermionic coordinates, and the Penrose diagrams are always drawn in the string x1 and x0 coordinates.
And explain.
Okay. So the black lines correspond simply to the ends of the Fermi C. So here is one end of the Fermi C, sort of the tail of the universe. And there it is, moving at the speed of light behind the universe.
So I'm supposed to think that the universe only exists inside the black hole?
Right. And we don't know the nature. I'm going to talk about this in a second. We don't know the nature about what this end is. This is some stringy kind of singularity, which is described in this model, though I haven't quite told you exactly the details of this cutoff. That's the difficulty here. But we don't know. In the space-time, it doesn't really have a space-time interpretation. They're purely stringy.
You really want to say more about that?
Sorry?
Look at what the fluctuation is
near. Right. Okay. So. That's a very good question, right? So the fluctuation near the fluctuations near the end are sort of interesting. So let me maybe, this was a bit of a motivational situation. Let me draw something a little more general. So it turns out that you can do this in a more general setup. This crescent shape isn't very special. And the reason why it's not very special is because if I start with some general oblong shape at zero time, it will also stretch into this long sheet that has a top and a bottom surface where fluctuations can live. And you can see that very easily by rotating the diagram and just thinking about stretching. Any arbitrary sort of fairly well-behaved shape that you have over here will stretch into a shape like that. And so this diagram, which I redrew here with some modifications, applies to a general kind of droplet of fermions. And so here is the difficulty, precisely the difficulty with these stringy edges, is that they depend crucially on precisely what shape you have in here. And we have not been able to exactly compute what happens. So we don't actually have a good understanding of what happens to perturbations. I can tell you this, that perturbations can cross both this edge and that edge. And so as the universe evolves, especially, so in the crescent was a little misleading, but when you start thinking about this droplet, When I draw these two sheets over here, it is not true that, well, so there's two sheets here. And it is not true that if a perturbation starts out on, say, on one of the sheets, that it will come out over here on the same sheet. It could swap to the different sheet. So you have to think, this universe has two sheets. The sheets are joined at these two stringy edges. The position of the edges is magically rotated as the universe passes through the singularity. And while the space-time picture is a little difficult to draw or to picture, to think about, except in these asymptotic regions where nothing interesting is happening, there is a precise computational prescription given by this, where if you tell me the shape of a perturbation coming in over here, I'll tell you what sheet it comes out on and what shape it comes out in, and whether it comes through or whether it becomes a strong perturbation that actually destroys the whole setup, because of course you can throw in enough energy that things go haywire.
You're talking about a singularity, presumably because you're imagining the droplet is very small. If your droplet is bigger, then your space-time interpretation continues to be there?
No.
No.
In fact, the droplet, as long as the droplet is finite, you will always get this picture. I'm calling it a singularity because it is the place where my space-time description and thinking about space-time completely breaks down. It's not a singularity in the sense of there being a point, and I need this droplet to be large enough to accommodate a large number of fermions so that I can think about it semi-classically. So I'm already in a limit where this droplet is large. The size of the droplet is not very physical.
I guess you're arguing that because you have excitations on the top and the bottom, these two excitations being two different universes, and not interacting with each other in the space-time picture.
For small energies, yes.
Yeah. I mean, there is one case where we have two surfaces, the two sizes of the hyperbola that are related to the supersymmetric string theory, and there in the space-time picture, things seem to interact with each other.
Yes, there. That's a very different setup. And this, if you wanted to lift this, so I haven't mentioned this. I didn't want to get into discussion of the supersymmetric stuff. And I'll be happy to talk to you later, but let me just briefly answer you. In fact, if you wanted to embed all of this in the supersymmetric story, you would actually have to have the whole field hyperbola on this side. When I talk about these two surfaces not interacting, I really do mean in the fermion model. And in the fermion model, you just see they're not interacting because the fermions don't interact.
I'm only objecting to the connotation that they're not interacting with the fermion picture, so they're not interacting with the space-time picture.
They interact for things with large energies. They do not interact for small perturbations. In the supersymmetric case, the interaction was, if I remember correctly, was coming from the fact that the space-time fields were either symmetric or anti-symmetric combinations of your two surfaces. In this case, this is not true. There's no reason to take symmetric or anti-symmetric combinations of the fields living on the two surfaces. Sorry, I can't hear you.
In that case, the interaction is effectively.
Yes, precisely, and that's suppressed by 1 over G string, which is roughly the distance.
Why don't we let Joanna carry on and finish her talk, and then we'll have lots of time for questions afterwards, okay?
It's okay. I have actually built the questions, and I knew they would be coming. Okay, so let me move on to the second topic, which is tachyon condensation, and start with a setup where the condensation happens on a time-like surface. So imagine the following situation. The hyperbola the standard static hyperbola is the one whose asymptotes are the little dashed lines over here, the ones that pass through the origin. So let's consider the blue lines over here, which don't pass through the origin. So shift the whole thing a little to the left and take a hyperbola that is asymptotic to this. It takes just a couple of minutes of thought to realize that this hyperbola will move, and it takes a couple more minutes of thought to write down the precise solution for how it will move. And from the solution, you see that the hyperbola, while it's its intercepts depend on time, its shape is actually a constant. And so what's happening here is a rigid translation of this hyperbola along some other actually hyperbolic track. Okay, so how do we picture that in the fermions? And the picture that I find very useful is to think about the following. Let's say that I had a potential which is drawn in a dashed green line over here. And I filled it up to some normal energy level, just like we usually do. And then let's say that suddenly somebody has come in and yanked this potential over there so fast that the Fermi C didn't have time to react. So now these guys are out of equilibrium. And of course, they're going to fall down. And that's precisely the state that I am describing here. All I've done here is just move this hyperbola to the left, just like I've just moved these fermions over there to the left. And so the time evolution is that there's some complicated incoming state which comes up, form the states, and comes back out. And we can write down, in fact, not just semi-classically, but the precise, it's very easy, you write down the precise quantum state that corresponds to this in either the first or the second quantized formalism, because it's just a shift. In general, you need a shift both in the x and the p direction, but I'm drawing the simplest case here. So what's happening here is that you have over here, when the hyperbola is sitting over here and extends, I haven't drawn it, but it extends the way it normally would, the universe looks almost, not quite, but essentially like the normal liberal universe that I described at the beginning. However, then the Fermi C goes away, and it just disappears. So just like here, you have a bunch of fermions, they form a normal universe, and suddenly, boom, your universe goes away. And so this really is looking like your universe is decaying, and it's decaying with the speed of light, hence time-like condensation. So using the formalism that I mentioned earlier from Joe Polchinski, we can compute from that solution that I wrote down for the exact shape of the hyperbola, we can compute, you can approximately compute what is the tachyon field in this setup. At least for small tachyons. We can't do it. None of this formalism doesn't hold that this field is large. But as long as this field is small, we can compute this. And so what is the space-time picture? So again, these are my string coordinates, x1 and x0. And here is my flat space. And in blue is the Liouville potential wall corresponding to this term here. And in green are the two potential walls that correspond to the other two fields, meaning I'm just drawing the point. This the line that I draw is just the point where this term is approximately one. So I'm going to be taken. That's roughly where the turnaround point is, depending on what the string's energy is. So these walls are fuzzy, of course, depending on how hard the strings can penetrate them. And so here's these two extra walls. And since string degrees of freedom cannot penetrate these potentials, they are actually limited to live in this red outlined region here. And so that's the universe. And so let's say that I was some time-like observer, which you can't have in this setup. At least string theory doesn't give you any variables to be time-like observers. But let's say that you're going over here on a time-like curve. Then you're going to see suddenly that this wall, which you can't penetrate, hits you. And just space. It's not that space disappears, because space-time exists on this whole square. It's just that no physical degrees of freedom, except perhaps for D-brains, which is still debatable, can actually penetrate through this. So this is why I would like to call this tachyon condensation. The tachyon field comes in and with the speed of light destroys the entire space-time, pushing the universe towards weak coupling on this side, or pushing all the degrees of freedom towards weak coupling. Let me just make one comment. So you might wonder a little, because I've told you the tachyon is massless. So how does it decay? So the words tachyon condensation are used, well, poetically. This is poetic license. We simply mean that you do get this. Actually, this is not a fluctuation that could have happened in the original theory. The original Liouville theory is stable. It does not have a tachyon. This is something that looks like tachyon condensation, but corresponds to a different theory. And the difference in the if you wanted to put this fluctuation into the original theory, its action is infinite. So this cannot happen spontaneously. which is good because we know the original theory was stable. Okay, so I have one more quick example to show you about another condensation setup with a slightly different solution. So first, let's think about this. So what would happen? It's easy to see by this thinking about rotated scenarios that the lines at 45 degrees, the dashed lines, are static. They just scale, but they don't actually move. However, any other line, let's say one over here, will move. So what will happen? Well, if you take a line that's almost 45 degrees but not quite, it will sit there for a fairly long time, and then it will fall. And it will fall in the time of order one, and then it will slowly approach the line on the bottom here. So let's consider having two of those with slopes sufficiently different, then the first one falls first, and then nothing happens for a long time, and then the second one falls. So this is going to be the setup, and now I want to add some fermions. And since we had hyperbolas asymptoting to the original lines, so let's have a hyperbolic-like shape asymptoting to these lines that do this falling down thing. So here they are, and so over here, not only are the fermions squished between these two lines that are very close together, they're actually, which I couldn't draw, all the way out there. They're really, really far away, and so they're really not there in your theory. But then the first line falls down, the universe opens up, and you actually get a picture that looks almost like the static livable universe. And then the top line falls down, and the fermions are drained very, very quickly. And just like in the previous case, there exists an exact solution for the geometry of these hyperbolas. These solutions were a lot of fun. I get to sit there and guess something and write a paper. So here is an exact solution, which we really did just get by inspection. And again, because we have this form of the fermion surface, we can compute what the tachyon potential looks like. And here it is. And I won't go through the details. I just wanted to point out to you that in the approximation where the tachyon is small, all the time, the extra piece that appears only depends on time and not on space. And so this is why we'd like to call this space-like tachyon condensation, because you suddenly get this tachyon condensation everywhere in your space. And I'm not sure exactly what the physical interpretation of that is. It looks to me a little like a phase transition. It would be very nice to work out the details of what actually happens. Okay, so let me just mention for the experts in the audience, I'll whip through the slide very quickly, that we have recently realized that this whole story is an example of open-closed string duality, that there is a connection to D-brains, and that these N by N matrices can actually be interpreted as the open string tachyon that lives on some large number of D-brains. And since a single eigenvalue traveling around here has been interpreted as an unstable, decaying D0 brain, the droplets that I talked about look like a stack of N of those brains, and we all know that stacks of brains are very interesting, and so this is sort of in the spirit of what one would like to do with the Sitter CFT. And that tachyon condensation, which I also described, looks like the decay of all the D0 brains coherently. So somehow all the brains making up your space just go away. So that's the quick review. So let me just wrap up. There's two ways of looking. Depending on what you're interested in, there's two ways of looking at these results. If you're interested in time-dependent cosmology, in time-dependent string theory and cosmology, then you're interested in the fact that there exist these various two-dimensional time-dependent scenarios which have a non-perturbative definition, where I can do things like resolve singularities and figure out how perturbations cross through phase transitions and things like this. And this is interesting. On the other hand, if you're interested in two-dimensional string theory and CFTs, then you now have a large number of new states in the C equals to one matrix model, which should be interpreted as various string theories, and in particular might lead to some novel CFTs. So that's all I have to say.
So we have time for questions?
Yeah. You're using a map to a closed string backgrounds, which is based on the usual Liouville wall and linear dilaton. And I was wondering to what extent that's really true for these droplets, because I would have said that the linear dilaton is related to the fact that the fermion density is growing linearly as you go to the left. And in your droplet cosmologies, the fermion density is finite everywhere, and it's going to zero on both ends of the droplet. So I would have said that sort of the droplet is strongly coupled at both ends and has finite coupling in the middle. So I'm not sure in what sense you can really use the intuitions that you get from the usual filled Fermi C and apply them to this cosmology. And then related to that is that if you make any ripple on the droplet because of the stretching, because of the stretching of the droplet profile, any ripple that you make always ends up on one end of the droplet or the other, where, if I'm right, everything's strongly coupled. So the second question is, what do you see as being appropriate observables for these droplets?
Okay, so your second question is not right. In fact, if you either write it down or look at it, you know, on some little computer models, these things don't tend to end up at the ends of droplets. There's only a small number of states that does. But there is a large region in the droplet where the perturbations do not pile on top of each other. Now, about the first question, it's an interesting point. So you have to be very careful when you talk about coupling. So I would say that if there was a CFT description, which there probably will not be, that there will be a linear dilaton, just like the regular one had. However, that might not necessarily be the string coupling. This is a very strange situation where we don't really have a string description. And I'm not sure whether, from the point of view of perturbations living on the surface of one of those droplets, the local sort of string interaction will still be governed by this dilaton that was there to begin with. But what happens when you come to the edge, we don't know. There is a strongly coupled problem there, you're right. But it's not necessarily because the coupling becomes strong.
Okay, in the translation between the field that corresponds to small fluctuations of the Fermi surface and the tachyon, there is this Legpole factor that is not very well understood. And this Legpole factor has poles exactly at the momenta that your sort of walls and different things were. So, I mean, have you thought more about that?
Okay, I knew you were going to ask it. yes, there are Legpole factors. Let me give a really quick answer, and I'll try to answer you in more detail later. I can't explain the whole story in 2 minutes. But yes, one is very right. I talked about the map between the fermionic picture and the string picture as if it was local. That map is not local, and there is a non-local transform that you have to apply in order to make sense of all of these things. Then the locality of this map can be thought of as having a whole bunch of derivatives. And because all of the solutions that I wrote down for the tachyon condensations are exponentials, those derivatives reduce down to just some numbers. And as one points out, the number comes out, in the place where we're actually studying, the number comes out to be infinite. And so there is an infinite renormalization that connects, that you have to work through, that connects the if you sort of naively apply the formalism that you have, you get that you need an infinite renormalization of couplings between the size of the perturbation in the Fermi C and the actual sort of world sheet effect. And I think you can just think of it as that. There's a way of regularizing this by taking it a little off the pole, and then you just carefully take limits, and you end up with a finite coupling.
Are there other questions?
Just more naive one. I mean, why should I think that putting a tachyon background, even small, leaves the theory, you know, scale invariant without modifying the metric or the dilaton.
I'm sorry, which theory? Leaves which theory scale invariant?
If I understood, maybe I misunderstood completely, but at the end you had this tachyon condensate.
Mm-hmm.
Can I think of this as having modified the tachyon background?
Yes, sure.
Yeah. So, I mean, can you do that? Can you deform your conformal field theory?
Ah, okay, so you're asking about the CFT.
Yeah, that's right. And I wonder why you don't modify the dilaton as well.
Well, actually, we're not too sure what we modify, because I wrote down for you a first couple of terms and what really needs to be a much larger expansion. And so this CFT, what I wrote down, you can just in 2 minutes convince yourself that what I wrote down will not give you a CFT. Because the different terms that you add in there they're all weight one. And so they are potentially marginal, but they cannot be simultaneously marginal in the same theory. So they will create a whole large number of other terms. In principle, you could take, and this has been done, well, to some extent has been attempted in a work by Aleksandrov, Kazakov, and Kostov, where they use the fact that this model has a total integrability condition to sort of see how you might, what kind of CFTs you will get if you actually try to include all of those different terms. They study in a slightly different context. But in principle, this can be done, and the CFT can be written down. And all of the correlators, the thing is that what you're really interested in is not the infinite expansion, the CFT, you're interested in the correlators. And the correlators can be exactly computed in the matrix model, and they do define a conformal field theory, even if it doesn't have an interpretation with a linear dilaton.
We have time for one more question. If not, let's thank Joanne again. And our